Good morning. It is 9:04 a.m. Welcome you to City Council briefing for Wednesday, August 5th, 2015. Is Pastor Bird here? There we go. Hey, Pastor, come on up right here to this. We're going to start with our invocation with Pastor Alex Bird, Senior Pastor of Living Faith Covenant Church. Pastor Bird has been in ministry, both in preaching and ministry of music, for 30 years. He's the co-pastor of Living Faith Covenant Church in Dallas. He provides leadership and guidance for other pastors as the regional bishop for the South, the Fellowship of Affirming Ministries, under the most capable leader of Bishop Flunder. Displaying commitment to higher learning, he has completed his master's at Bright Divinity School and is leading to a PhD with sociology emphasis. Thank you for being here and following that. Ms. Young will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. All rise. Thank you.
Shall we pray? To the God that is known by many names, to whom I access through Christ Jesus, we speak to the universe that encompasses us all. We entreat the human spirit that makes living what it is. We pray now for your divine wisdom, wisdom to listen attentively, wisdom to advocate for those whose voice are rendered silent or mute, wisdom to act in the best interests of all the citizens of this diverse city of Dallas, of red, yellow, black, white, brown, and every hue of the racialized human rainbow, of people of low, middle, high, and even no estate, of male, female, and transgender experience, of straight, gay, bisexual, and unidentified sexual expressions. Let all that is done today be beneficial to all of us, your offspring and your essence. Help us so that we may increase as a model city in economics, in transportation, in aesthetics, housing and development, municipal services, but in grace and justice most of all. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We come to City Hall in different capacities, and we serve our citizens, but we, in doing so, become one big family. When we lose a family member, an employee, it is a tough day for us. And we had one of our newest employees pass away this weekend, and I wanted Councilman McGue to introduce him in the past and tell us a little bit about him, and we're going to take a moment of silence on the death of Adam Anderson. Mr. McGue.
Well, thank you, Mayor. Thank you, colleagues. Over the past 3 months, I've gotten to know one of the most special human beings I've met. Daniel Blake Anderson worked with me on my campaign. He knocked on thousands of doors all over the district, and you know how much fun that can be. And he always approached it with humility, kindness, and he was willing to engage in every kind of discussion you can imagine. And I got to know him very well, so much so that he loved the people he talked with. He loved the work we were doing in District 10. He loved what we were doing in the city and became very attracted to the policy discussions and some of the things that we were having at different times throughout the campaign. And so he decided to come and work here at City Hall, join my team, and we spent the last month really kind of going through all the strategies and plans and all the stuff we wanted to do for our district and the city. Really, really an impressive young man. He was born and raised here in Dallas, graduated high school at Jesuit College, Jesuit College Preparatory, where he was involved in football, rugby, wrestling, and volunteering, often at the Austin Street Shelter. He's also an Eagle Scout, well-read. He studied all over the country. In fact, he studied finance at Wake Forest, forensic anthropology at the University of Tennessee, got his degree in political philosophy at the University of Dallas, and was starting his MBA this fall at the University of Dallas as well. Additionally, he's volunteered all over the globe. He was involved in medical missions and was a Children's International Summer Village Scholar. He participated in missions in Bosnia, Canada, Chile, Costa Rica, Denmark, Honduras, Italy, and the Philippines. He's just absolutely a servant at heart, and we're so thankful to have him as part of the team starting. Blake's family, I got to spend good time with him yesterday. Loving family, involved in same kind of service all over our city, and just really hope that all of us can spend some time and prayers around that family as we move forward. And I'll just leave you with the thoughts from his mother yesterday. She said, "Blake's still got your back. He's still working with all of us, and he's got all of our back." So I appreciate this and just really appreciate the moment of silence this morning.
Thank you. So would everyone bow their heads, and let's have a moment of silence in memory of Mr. Anderson. Thank you, Ms. McGill.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mayor Pro Tem, you wanted to announce a passing as well.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I also just wanted to ask everyone for their prayers to the family of a member of the Greater Dallas Asian Chamber of Commerce, Mr. Mahbub Mani Rahman. He passed away early Monday morning due to a heart attack. But also, Mayor, a good friend of mine who happens to be the grandfather of First Assistant Chief Chief Cato also passed, and we want to extend our prayers and condolences to all the family of the chief, as well as you know, the immediate family of Mr. Rahman. So I wanted to ask if when they pray, if they can extend some prayers for those families. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
And thank you. We will open our morning with our open microphone speakers. Welcome back.
Yes, welcome back.
We have some returning folks.
We do. We have your microphone. Your first five top speakers are Flora Hernandez, Kermit Mitchell, Valencia Carter, Michael Simmons, and Regina Imbrugia. I will first recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of the City Council. Any speaker making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks will be removed from the session of the meeting. Individuals are allowed 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice the timer on the television screen. And when your time is up, please allow the next individual their turn. You should state your name and address for the record, as well as please clarify the topic that you're speaking to. If you have any handouts, we recommend you go ahead and pass them out to the security officer. At the time your name is called, that is when the timer starts. And so it does affect your speaking time if you try to distribute them when you're to come up to the podium. Again, your first speaker is Flora Hernandez.
Thank you, Ms. Rios. My name is Flora Hernandez, and I'm at 6042 Preston Shire Lane, Dallas, Texas, 75225. Good morning, Mayor Rollins, City Council Manager Gonzalez, City Council members, and staff. I'm here to ask your assistance to fill the vacancies both on the Civil Service Board and the Adjunct Board. By charter, the Civil Service Board is comprised of 7 members. The mayor nominates 1 candidate to serve as the chair, and the city council members nominate 6 additional candidates to serve on the board. Each of the 7 nominees must be approved by the full council to be appointed for a 2-year term. The members of the Civil Service Board determine the vice chair by majority vote, and I'm the vice chair of the board. Currently, we are staffed at 6 members, and we have 1 vacancy. The 7th member is needed to share the responsibilities of overseeing the Civil Service Department of the City of Dallas. The mission of the board is to guide and direct the function of rules, regulations, and guidelines that relate to maintaining an employment system based on merit and fitness. Our guiding principle is to reduce the time it takes for managers to receive a qualified eligibles list. So we really need your help. The board has only 7 of 15 adjunct board members. Each city council member may nominate a candidate to serve as an adjunct member. So we have 8 vacancies on the adjunct board. Please nominate someone in your district who you believe would be worthy of serving the citizens of Dallas in this capacity. Adjunct board members serve on trial boards. Trial boards are held to hear appeals from employees. Employees who have experienced certain adverse personnel actions, for example, a demotion or termination, are eligible to appeal that action before a trial board. The trial board has a quasi-judicial power, including the power to subpoena witnesses. The trial board is composed of a chair who is a member of the Civil Service Board and 2 adjunct board panel members. In closing, I ask you to make nominations to the Civil Service Board and the Adjunct Board. I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Your next speaker, Kermit Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell will be followed by Valencia Carter, Michael Simmons, Regina Bergia.
Good morning. My name is Kermit Mitchell, 5659 Marblehead Drive, Dallas, Texas, 75232, District 3. I'm here about the purchase of the Omni Dallas Convention Center Hotel. This is a proposal to purchase the Omni Dallas Convention Center Hotel from the City of Dallas. City Manager A.C. Gonzalez has publicly stated that the city should not be in the hotel business. City Manager A.C. Gonzalez has publicly stated that the city would entertain offers to buy the hotel. This is a proposal to repay the city $479 million that was the original financing to build the hotel. This is a proposal to move the hotel to private ownership in fair competition with the other hotels that are taxpayers. Private ownership would benefit the Omni due to lessening the competitive internal public scrutiny of all their operations. In summary, this is a proposal to purchase the hotel and pay full price for the hotel, even though I might add that it is appraised at half that value. It is to protect the hotel from competitive public inquiry, serve the public interest, and we ask your vote towards selling the Omni Dallas Convention Center Hotel. If there are any questions to me, I have a moment, I believe, here to entertain any questions.
Thank
you for this opportunity to speak to you today. And we join the applause for the new sitting Dallas City Council. A wide range of experiences have brought you here, from fight to the finish runoff campaigns, from majority votes in the first time, to uncontested re-elections. These are all variations of the hard work and promise of public service that have earned you all your well-deserved seats in this city council. Congratulations to you all, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell.
Your next speaker, Valencia Carter. Ms. Carter will be followed by Michael Simmons and Regina Ambrosia.
Good morning. My name is Valencia Carter, 4400 West University Boulevard, Dallas, Texas, 75209. And my topic is to advocate on behalf of deaf and hard of hearing drivers. There's a common myth that deaf and hard of hearing people live lives totally different from the rest of the world. That's just not true. Deaf and hard of hearing people work, go to school, get married, have families, and they drive. There's no law that prevents them from driving. And because of that right and privilege, the chances that they will have interactions with the police is more likely than not. It's my goal to ensure that the interaction is positive for all parties involved. This can be done by providing training on deaf culture and sensitivity, and if legally possible, providing a location where a placard can be attained by deaf and hard of hearing drivers. identifying them as deaf and providing instructions on the best way to communicate with them. That's my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you for coming in.
Next speaker, Michael Simmons. Michael Simmons is not present. Regina Ambergia, not present. Will Mina. Mr. Mina, you're not required to read your address into the record since you're a minor. Okay, so just state your name only.
Good morning. My name is Will Mina, and I live on 9607 Hilldale Drive in District 10. I'm going to be in the sixth grade at Merriman Park Elementary. This is my brother, Harrison, and he will be in second grade. We love riding our bikes to school, but we need a school zone on Church Road at Torrey Sound because it isn't safe to get across. Each day we ride with our friends, and our mom or dad or another parent has to help us get across the street because cars are flying past us. After school, it's even worse because the teenagers from Lake Highlands High School get out of school and speed on Church Road. My brother was almost hit a few times, even with an adult trying to help us. Does everyone have their sheet of paper? So as you can see on the paper, the crosswalk signs that the city put up are hard to see until you come right up on the crosswalk. My dad told us that when he was little, he used to ride his bike to Merriman Park, and there was a school zone on Church Road, and he had a crossing guard. We need the city to put the school zone back so it can help slow down the cars so that we can get across safely. Our principal and many parents have called asking for the school zone or a traffic light, but they have all been told no. I don't understand why. All of the other neighborhoods that lead to our school have a school zone and a crossing guard. We have nothing. Church Road is a four-lane road, and the speed limit is 35, but cars are going faster than that. Last year, a police officer came out and wrote a whole bunch of speeding tickets one morning at that intersection. He even told us it was unsafe to cross. I passed out a petition that was signed by many of our neighbors asking for help for you to see. So please put the school zone back so we don't get hurt. Please, thank you. And thank you for your time.
Very good presentation. It's great to have you here. Mr. McGew.
Yeah, Will, I just want to say thank you for coming down here. Thank you for participating. I share some of your frustration, and we will continue to work on this. But wonderful presentation, and really appreciate it. That's a future Lake Highlands Wildcat over there. So thank you.
Your next speaker is Mathis Perkins. Mr. Perkins will be the final speaker this morning. The three remaining speakers under additional open microphone will be called in the afternoon.
Good morning. Your Honors, I live in an area of District 40 that has long been bereft of adequate city services, and that lack of adequate services continues to this day. I have, the reflex response given when addressing city staff is called 311. I've called 311 ad nauseum. I've used the 311 app over and over again. I've submitted countless service requests via the 311 website. Still, the results are piecemeal and patchwork at best. A more enlightened response has been form a group and get your neighbors involved. And there are and have been 9 neighborhood groups between I-35 and I-45 north of Illinois and south of the Trinity River that have been in existence for some time. And I am an active participant in 7 of those 9 groups. I have attended numerous code outreaches and Grow South updates. I've been informed of the Neighborhood Plus effort. It has been pointed out at the Grow South presentation that there are no initiatives in our community. And the response has been by city staff that we are actually in what they call the donut hole. We are not targeted for any of the Neighborhood Plus program initiatives. City staff has stated more than once that when the programs do kick off, more stringent code enforcement will be used as a tool to improve the community. Why wait? Let's start now. I've written or spoken to department heads, council people, city manager's office, and the mayor's office. Systemically, nothing is being done. The ultimate response that you get is it's been turned over to nuisance abatement. And nuisance abatement is the abyss from which there is no return, because we have no way of contacting, there's no accountability with nuisance abatement. This is not new, it's gone on for generations. And what I ask this body is to provide this area with the customary services befitting citizens of Dallas. End the diplomacy of bait and switch, stop the practice of mollification and pacification, and correct the problem at the base and then build upwards. Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes your speakers this morning. We move now to your first item on the voting agenda is approval of minutes of the June 17, 2015 City Council meeting and June 22, 2015 special and inauguration meetings.
Are there any edits or additions?
I have one
edit. Mr. Wilson.
On the June 17 meeting, the 2 p.m. meeting, I'd like to make a correction. My name was misspelled, E-R-I-K. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. With that amendment, we've got a motion and a second. Any other comments? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Your next item is consideration of appointments to boards and commissions. You do have for full council appointment to the Ethics Advisory Commission, and I'm sorry, Councilmember Kleiman is withdrawing himself from the council chamber due to a conflict of interest. So to the Ethics Advisory Commission, you have Mark H. Kleiman is nominated by Mayor Rawlings, and he is being appointed for the 2013-15 term to the Employees Retirement Fund Board of Trustees. Councilmember Kleiman is being nominated and appointed by Mayor Rawlings, and this is for the 2015-2017 term. And of course, he fills the qualification of being a council member. Also to the Police and Fire Pension Board is representing the City Council are Council Members Lee Kleiman, Council Member Scott Griggs, Council Member Philip T. Kingston, and Council Member Eric Wilson. These nominees will serve for the 2015-17 term, which will end on the inauguration day of 2017, and any members possibly not reelected at that time would continue and hold over, and members are to be appointed as soon as practicable after that time.
Ms. Rios, I just have a question. Do we have, do Mr. Kleiman, Mr. Griggs, Mr. Kingston, Mr. Wilson have a conflict since we're voting on them? Somehow we're voting on something.
Yes.
We don't. Okay, that's fine. All right, do we have a motion to approve? Do we have a second?
Excuse me.
Well, do we have a motion and a second? And a second? Okay, and discussion, Ms. Grayson.
Thank you, Mayor. Mr. Kleinman's brother on the Ethics Advisory Commission, I'm sort of uncomfortable with that. It's a sibling of a council member, and that's a unique board that gets to make decisions about council members, and it just struck me as inappropriate. I think if it was a different board, I wouldn't have any problem. I don't know Mr. Mark Kleinman. I'm sure he's a fine man. I'm sure he's very ethical. I just don't think it's appropriate to appoint a council member sibling to the Ethics Advisory Commission that can be making decisions on his colleagues' ethics.
Motion to split the vote.
Second. In what way?
Yeah, I was gonna say I would like to separate out that particular nomination from the others.
Separate the board.
So we will take a vote on the. Let's see, we've got a motion and a second. So we're going to. How do I pull that off? Okay, so we'll vote on that. The motion to split, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, so now we've taken that motion off. We'll split the motion. So we have a motion on Since the discussion has been about Mr. Kleinman, we will take a motion for Ethics Advisory Commission. Do we have a motion to approve? No one wants to, does anybody want to hear about Mr. Kleinman? Okay, motion fails, okay. Do we have a motion to approve the others? We have a second? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any question? No conflict. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion is carried. I will bring a new appointee back.
Okay, we move now to item number 3. To authorize amendments to the 2015 city calendar to number 1, move the vote to adopt the budget on the first reading from Wednesday, September 9 to Wednesday, September 2, 2015. Number 2, move the council budget amendments workshop from Wednesday, September 16 to Tuesday, September 8, 2015 at 3 o'clock p.m. and Wednesday, September 9, 2015 as needed. Number 3, move the vote to adopt the budget on the second reading from Wednesday, September 23 to Wednesday, September 16, 2015. And number 4, move the City Council agenda meeting from Wednesday, September 23 to Wednesday, September 30th, 2015.
Mr. Wilson?
So moved.
We have a motion to second. Any discussion? Ms. Grayson?
I am going to be out of town on the 30th and would hate to miss the entire rest of the agenda meeting. And I made those plans before this came up. And so, I mean, it puts me in a difficult position because I'm going to have to miss the September 30th meeting, which I wouldn't have made those plans had I thought we were going to move it.
I don't think anybody thought we were going to move it. This is Yom Kippur, and it was shouldn't have been scheduled on that. We all voted on it, and none of us saw it. So,
except that, isn't it true that we can meet until like 2 o'clock in the afternoon?
It's not Arab.
Pardon?
It is the day.
Oh, it's the day. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, maybe yes. There's a different day that we could do this.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Medrano?
Yeah, I have the same conflict that Ms. Grayson has. I'll be out of town as well. I suggested that we move it to the 22nd since court doesn't start till the evening. Doesn't look like it's going to be a long agenda, so maybe we can get done pretty early. So that's the recommendation I made to have the meeting on the 22nd.
Is that a Tuesday?
It's a Tuesday.
I'm going to second that.
I'm sorry, was there a motion? There was a motion.
Yep. Motion okay. To, for the 22nd.
I heard the second.
And to clarify the motion, Mr. Mayor, does that then obviate the need for the other changes? We're not going to make the other changes?
Everybody was going to be gone on Tuesday, that's what I was told. Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. Okay?
Well, everybody.
Excuse me. What the city manager told me is we couldn't get a quorum on those dates. Okay? So that's the reason he brought it forward that way. So, but we have a motion and a second. Ms. Arnold.
It's me, Mr. Mayor.
Can we, it's been a month and we haven't fixed this yet? I think we saw this issue a month ago.
It's fine.
I don't want for the next 2 years to be always calling you Ms. Arnold.
Thanks, okay. Mr. Mayor. I also have a conflict. I'm not out of town, and I can clear it. It's not my first choice. But I wanted to raise also the idea that this budget is the largest in the City of Dallas's history, and I anticipate the largest number of budget amendments ever submitted by any council. And shortening the time for understanding the budget, debating the budget, and talking with the public about the budget is unwise. Thank you.
All right, just to clarify, I think it's important, your point is important, and I want to, therefore, you're saying what? That we shouldn't be moving the date?
Any shortening of the time for reading and adopting the budget is unwise.
Gotcha. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, guys. So this is a group decision here. Are we moving it to Tuesday and people are not going to go to TML? Mr. Medrano.
Well, I know that at the beginning of TML, if we get done pretty early, you'll still be there in the evening and you'll have 3 more days of TML.
Yeah.
It's not like you're missing a whole lot, so I think that'll work.
I will not be there on the 22nd. Okay.
But I know that that's what most of the people are going to TML.
That's fine.
If you head out in the afternoon, it's fine. We've done that before.
All the facts to be known. I'm not going to be there on the 22nd. All right. So, Mr. Kleinman.
I mean, can we just maybe see just a show of hands who cannot be on the 22nd?
Excuse me. Who can't?
Cannot attend on the.
That's
22nd.
A great way to do it. Okay. Thank
just
you.
Just so we can get a general idea.
Everybody else can? Okay.
You good. can be here on the 22nd.
All right. Well, then I thought that the people were going to be gone on the 22nd. So that's good. Let's.
Does everything else then stay the way it was before?
I mean,
because like moving the budget to adopt the budget on the first reading from the 9th to the 2nd, I have a town hall meeting on the 1st. So I kind of hate to push all of that up to the point where I'm going to be voting, you know, on the first reading of the budget adoption the morning after I have a town hall meeting. Well, that's just, I'm uncomfortable with that.
The requested change would be for the second reading, the September 22nd, right, would be the first?
We have a series of changes suggested here, and I was talking about the very first one where we're moving the vote to adopt the budget on the first reading from the 9th to the 2nd, when some of us have town hall meetings that are very close to that date of voting on the first reading.
Okay. Did you have something to add, Ms. Chipperfield?
No, I was just correcting Ms. Rios.
Okay. Yes, Ms. Alonzo.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Ms. Chipperfield or Mr. Gonzalez, do we need to make a decision today on these dates and or, and can, I mean, I guess there was some conflicts on some dates and maybe we can clarify within 1 week from today?
So the reason that I asked for the vote today is because we are about to print the budget book and it includes the budget schedule. So all of our documents that we publish will have the updated schedule in it. So my apologies for the rush, but that is why I'm asking for this today.
So the answer is yes.
What happens if it's not printed in the book? What if it just says a big TBD?
We could certainly put a TBD in the book. Town hall meetings start next week, and we want to be able to provide the schedule to anybody attending town hall meetings. So that is.
Excuse me, Ms. Gates.
I don't see a benefit if we, I mean, when are we going to decide it then, if we don't decide it today? I mean,
There are two issues, and let's capture, there are two issues. One is when we're going to do the remainder of the agenda schedule for the 23rd, okay? And the second is, are we going to move the adoption of the budget on that day as well, okay? And so they were separated. One was pushing things up, and then the other was the remainder. Now it can be all said, everybody, we could do it on the 22nd. I will not be there. So you will not be having the mayor at the adoption of the budget, but you will have a quorum.
Right, I mean, to accomplish, okay. I mean, to not meet on the 30th, we've got to move it up. So you kind of, you can't have it both ways. I would, you know, or we meet on the 30th and we move it all back down. right? I mean, is the issue.
Explain why we can't move the budget on the 30th.
So our contract with Dallas County to do the tax billing and collection requires the city to adopt a tax rate no later than the September 23rd.
Excuse me, Mr. Kleiman.
So if we adopt the budget on the 22nd, we're only adopting it one day prior to the requirement of the county.
Yes, but it still meets the requirement.
Right.
Right.
So, I mean, to Ms. Grace's point, I know you don't want to adopt it too soon, but it's only one day difference. The adoption date is only one day different if we adopt it on the 22nd.
I'm fine with adopting it on the 22nd. I just wanted to go back to the way things were. I think, well, I mean, we've made decisions as to scheduling town hall meetings, et cetera, based on the previous schedule of dates for adoption, for amendments, for workshops, for all that kind of thing. So I'm fine with moving the meeting to the 22nd. I'm fine with that. But then we have a whole series of other dates that are being moved around here.
As a result.
And I just would like to keep them the way they were.
Well, look, it's very simple, okay? It sounds like that we would not be moving other dates if we adopted the 22nd. And it sounds like everybody's going to be here except for me. Okay? So do you want to do this? Do you want to adopt the budget without the mayor or not? I'm not taking it personally, but you just, we all know what adopting the budget means. Okay? So. Okay, but we have, so let's revisit our motion. The motion was that for Adam, because you made that, Mr. Medrano, you made, that was a motion for both items?
To move the...
Please speak, turn your mic on. No, your mic's not on.
To move the date to the 22nd, the meeting from the 30th to the 22nd.
And
only.
Excuse me.
And that was my motion.
Are you talking about the remainder or the adoption of the budget as well?
The adoption as well.
The adoption as well. Okay. So everything would move. We would move then from the 16th, okay, the adoption of the budget, the 16th to the 22nd, and the remainder of the budget from the 30th to the 22nd. I think that's what you're saying, correct?
Pretty
much. Is that a yes?
Yes.
Okay, and that was your second, Mr. Kingston?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Ms. Grayson. Oh, Ms. Grayson.
Okay, let me be sure I understand this. We would be moving the adoption of the budget to Tuesday, September 22nd. What would happen with the rest of all of these changes, these proposed changes? They would just go back to the way they were.
They would.
We wouldn't need to do that.
They would.
And then on the 30th, we wouldn't have a meeting.
Correct. That's the implications of this.
But the mayor wouldn't.
But I'm not here.
All right. Thank you for the clarification.
Mr. Kleiman.
I'm sorry. Just to confirm with Jane or whoever, to clarify your clarification. Basically, what we're doing is looking at taking everything we had originally on the 23rd and moving to the 22nd, which does not shift any other of these dates on the calendar that we're looking at.
Yes, that's
so,
the...
So none of these highlighted dates on the calendar on the 2nd, the 8th, the 9th, all those shifts no longer.
Right, so those would go away.
That would go away. Okay. So all we're doing is actually moving that day back one. Okay.
Yes. Thanks.
Okay, well, any other discussion?
Can the mayor,
Mr. Kleiman?
Do you have the ability to attend
no.
the phone or anything?
I don't. Once I'm out, I can't vote. I've got it's hundreds of people that are, this is impacting. So my inability to change my calendar, I've already looked at that. Okay. I'm going to bring the 21st and the 22nd. Yeah. So, didn't help. Okay, we've got a motion on the floor. So, let's have a, probably, this is important enough issue. We'll have a roll call vote. Okay? And the motion is to move everything to the 22nd. We go back to the original calendar, and we do not take the remainder of the days, the remainder of the actions on the 30th. We have them on the 22nd. All right?
Mayor Rawlings?
No.
Mayor Pro Tem Alonzo?
No.
Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Wilson?
No.
Councilmember Griggs?
Yes.
Councilmember Medrano?
Yes.
Councilmember Thomas?
No.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Callahan?
Yes.
Councilmember Young?
No.
No? Councilmember Clayton?
Yes.
Councilmember McGue?
Yes.
Councilmember Kleinman?
No.
Councilmember Grayson?
Yes.
Councilmember Gates?
No.
Councilmember Kingston?
Yes.
There's eight in favor. And seven against. The motion carries, Mr. Mayor.
Motion passes. We'll make those arrangements. Thank you very much. We will now take on briefing A. I think you're still up there, Ms. Rios.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And I'll try to make it brief. We were able to provide you notebooks related to this presentation as well as the PowerPoint to allow you time to review it. So I'll try to not go over every little detail within it. There's some statistics that we're providing which lets you know that we have 49 board and commission members that are appointed by the full city council. 16 of those boards are individual boards, and with 33 full council boards, three are appointed by the nominator, appointed by the mayor, by the city manager. One, of course, is appointed by the mayor, and that is the Dallas Housing Authority. We have the classifications, as you know, quasi-judicial. They do have decision-making authority that may not always be required to come to the council for ratification. Advisory boards are self-explanatory. They advise you on certain issues or policies. Instrumentality are like the Dallas Housing Finance Corporation Board and Southern Dallas Development. They're able to make certain decisions that are beneficial to running and operating and financing small businesses in Dallas. And of course, you have miscellaneous, which are municipal management districts. Now, there are some boards and commissions that do require special qualifications, and your notebook does have some of those. If you have any questions, please let us know. I will let you know that for those special boards and commissions, usually those that there are some seats that do not require special qualifications, and those are the very first ones to fill. So it's those special qualifications that are a little bit of the hardest ones. So we would appreciate you looking at those that require the special qualifications be met. Terms, of course, are 2 years. We follow the same scenario as we do with council terms. So individuals come up for appointment, reappointment every 2 years. Most of the terms end September 30th and begin October 1. There are some positions, of course, based on the classification of the board that hold over for like a 9-month period. And the advisory boards hold over for 9 months. At that point in time, if you don't reappoint them, we notify the individuals that their service has ceased. And for the quasi-judicial instrumentality and some of the other special boards, they're able to hold over until either they resign or you appoint somebody in their place. Once appointed, you should know that a board member cannot be removed unless it's for cause, and it would require a public hearing before the city council. The service eligibility. Of course, you have to be a resident of Dallas for 6 months. There is no requirement that they live within your specific district. So you can appoint people that are outside of your district. They do need to be a qualified voter at the time of appointment, have no criminal record considered to be serious that it would affect, or could possibly be a disqualification. If something does turn up, we present such situations to the city council in executive session in the event the council member decides to proceed with a nomination. that can't be an adversary party on any pending litigation. They cannot have any monies owed in the several services, library, property taxes, water, tickets, etc. And of course, they have to have a credible record of attendance. If by chance you happen to nominate and want to reappoint a person that has had previous attendance issues and were forfeited, there is a statement that we read into the record that allows the rest of the council to know that this individual had attendance issues. And of course, we make the nominating council member aware of those. As you know, for officer appointments, the mayor nominates the chairs. For the boards and for the Board of Adjustment vice chairs. Individual council members nominate the vice chair. Of course, council ratification is required. We do hold vice chair nominations until 50% of the board has been filled. This allows the rest of the council members to hopefully appoint people in case that kind of make the appointment a little bit more equitable. We do provide some certain reports that I'll go over here in a little bit. As you know, for the vetting process, all board nominees are required to fill a NeoGov application, which is online. And once we receive an application, we forward it to your staff, and they can forward it to you, let you know who's basically on the hopper. And they do need to review it to make sure that the application has been filled out in its entirety and that they meet whatever special qualifications, if it's a special qualification board. For the background check, once you're interested in nominating an individual, we do need the application as well as a nominating memo. We would appreciate you indicating what place number, if it is for appointment to a full council board. Otherwise, what we normally do is appoint to a vacant position if there's one on that board. And of course, we go through the background check. As shown, my office does check for ethics, elections, or attendance conflicts. And of course, in the elections arena, we're basically talking, making sure they're not a candidate for another seat or serving as a treasurer for either a special purpose committee or another office holder candidate. And of course, the attorney's office does the conflict of interest checks. City manager's office goes through the indebtedness checks. And the Dallas Police Department does do the criminal background checks. The nominee process, there's some stats here for 2013. You can see the variable. There was a 3% increase in 2015. We still continue doing all the processing with two full-time employees. And the average background check is 45 days at the beginning of the process. Obviously, the closer we get to the term end or, you know, maybe the holdover end of the holdover period, that can decrease to up to 30, maybe 20, 25 days. And we do appreciate and would ask for your patience and understanding. We do try to process everybody as we receive them. Every once in a while we get backlogged, but we try to, you know, schedule our work to make sure that we process them as soon as possible. But you're looking at the beginning, you're really looking at that 45 day. And to be fair to everybody, again, we process them as we receive them. There's some certain status reports that I'm providing. We provide you these reports on the Friday. We'll go to slide 12, please. The nominee status report here, you can see where we've indicated the different sections and how to be able to read the report. It gives you the nominating district, the nominating council member, or possibly co-nominating council members. Of course, whatever the status is on the background check, for example, on number two, we would have sent that individual a letter advising possibly of, you know, a conflict or possibly a city manager showing that they have obligations owed, et cetera. On number four, here it shows you when we received the nomination, which is the nominating memo, not necessarily when they submitted the application. And number five, of course, shows you the history. And then the legend is depicted on number six. So when you see a yes, basically that part of the background check has been completed. If you see a P, meaning that there's a problem under that department. And the next report, we do provide you a board and commission matrix. You can see the different descriptors here. These are designed for you to understand, you know, what each code or each alphabet letter means. It can be a holdover if it's the city manager has a problem, indicated that there's a problem with an obligation owed. So we wanted to make sure that you understood that report when you get it. And we do update that every Friday. We also provide you a chair, vice chair matrix that allows you to view what boards have either had a chair or vice chair appointed, how many chair or vice chairs nominations we've received, and what's possibly pending. Again, at the beginning, you'll see that, you know, we do have maybe some vice chairs pending because of that 50 percentile, and it indicates the percentage of the board. So usually once a chair has been appointed, what we do is we go ahead and drop off that board, so the report gets smaller and smaller. At the beginning, of course, it'll be pretty big. We did provide you also a notebook that had certain information, and the different tabs outlined some of the information that will be of value to you. We, of course, provided, you know, appointment highlights. I do want to bring your attention to the chair and vice chair, which is on tab 5. We did provide their contact information as it stands now, and a lot of the board members request that their personal information not be released, so that that report for now is not releasable to the public unless redacted. We provided the member term data, which is under tab 6, and that lets you know the number of terms that an existing board member is, whether they're in holdover status, which is typically basically every board member right now is in, what the classification of the board is, whether it's a full council board or individual appointment board. And we also provided just some other Dallas Code and Charter excerpts for your information when you're looking at either appointment restrictions or term. And that concludes my report. Is there any questions?
Are there any questions, comments? Hearing none, we will move to item B on the Aquatic Facilities Master Plan. I think Mr. Kleinman has a motion.
Thank you, Mayor. I make a motion to defer this item.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Ms. Grayson.
Second.
Oh, second. I'm sorry. I thought you wanted to say something. Okay. Our well wishes to Willis. And then item C.
Is there a specific date, or is it just a general?
We wanted this item to be briefed by a director of Parks and Recreation who is not available today, so mm-hmm. I would defer this item until he is available to brief it.
Okay. Thank you.
So unfortunately, it is indefinite.
Yeah. Thank you. So
indefinite. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried. Mr. Gonzalez. Discussion on
living wage. We have a presentation. Gene and Chip Hill will be presenting, as well as Mike Frosch. So, Gene, if you would go ahead and start.
Good morning. We have a short informational briefing on living wage. We want to provide the council with an overview of our current practice, and as well as trying to provide the fiscal impact to the city on mandating a minimum wage floor or living wage on the city's contracts. So a living wage is a wage that would be high enough to maintain a normal standard of living. The normal standard of living is somewhat subjective. So instead of using the term living wage, we have used the word wage floor for this briefing. And as well, we have assumed that amount to be $10.25 per hour. That was recommended in the Mayor's Task Force on Poverty last August. So a little bit of background on the wage floor and various wage requirements that the city has had. Excuse me, this topic has been discussed in the past. In May of 2008, the city council directed that the wage requirements that we had in certain contracts be removed, and that all contracts are allow for the market to establish the contractor's wages to their employees. Again, last August, there was a briefing by the Mayor's Task Force on Poverty. One of the recommendations of that task force was to set a minimum hourly rate of $10.25 on city contracts. There was also some discussion during last year's budget related to the hourly rate paid to the sanitation temporary employees. That discussion was followed up with a briefing this past June. The Quality of Life Committee heard a briefing. It discussed the additional cost to the city to hire the day laborers to be approximately $4 million per year. That would be added to the monthly residential sanitation fee. What was also discussed was creating an opportunity for temporary laborers to become city employees, and at that time the committee directed the staff to proceed with the pilot program of that concept. In June of this year as well, the BF&A committee heard a briefing related to the recommended security services contract. The staff was able to obtain the pay rates for the employees covered under that contract, the contractor's employees, and the overwhelming majority, 87% of the proposed contractor's employees were being paid above the $10.62 per hour, which is the city's minimum wage on full-time employees. There was also discussion on June 24th regarding the Love Field concessions to modify those contracts to include a living wage as it's defined in those agenda items, or wage floor provision. So those will be, those amendments would be considered next week on your agenda. Some information about the city's contracts. We have approximately 80 or so labor, general service, concession revenue contracts that are in place that serve our citizens, our customers. We spend over $100 million a year in service contracts. The vendors don't tell us on our service contracts, for the most part, how much they're paying their employees. Some of our contracts don't have an hourly rate. We don't pay by the hour, we pay by the task or the service. So it's difficult to estimate what the employees may actually be paid and what the implications might be to raise their salaries. And we do require that the vendors follow federal minimum wage law. So going back, we followed the council's 2008 direction, so none of our labor service contracts are structured to include a minimum wage above the federal minimum. We allow the market to determine the wage rate. So just a short summary chart that we'll go into more detail about in a minute, and then also a history on the current federal minimum wage, where it's been and where it is now. So $7.25 an hour, with the last change went into effect in July of 2009. So we divided up our contracts into three primary categories: service, concession, labor, and construction. So our service contracts, they provide a fixed service level that the vendor needs to provide. The price is fixed for each of the services that the city is receiving, or on concession contracts, we would receive a revenue share. So the contract will probably have a component of labor and a component of additional services, materials, supplies that the vendor provides, and then rolls that into a single rate for the city. Some of the examples would be our mowing contract. We pay by location, we pay per acre, we don't pay an hourly wage. Armored car service, we pay per pickup. Concession contracts are a revenue share, so we have food and beverage, we have car rental, grounds maintenance as well by facility. And then our second category, labor. So we request a billable rate on certain labor contracts. So while the vendor must pay the minimum wage, so our security guard contracts, our temporary clerical labor office workers, and IT staff as well. And then finally, our third category is construction contracts. Our Texas statutes require that the city have the contractors pay their employees what is called the prevailing wage rates. The city council adopts the prevailing wage rates. They were adopted last in August of 2012. Additionally, if we have a federally funded project, we have to follow the Davis-Bacon Act, which has a similar provision for paying prevailing wages. They are set by job category, so each type of job, electrician, for example, glazier, they're all set at a prevailing wage rate. So the city doesn't have the authority to preempt the state or federal law on construction contracts. So we also took a look at how an increase in the minimum wage or a wage floor might affect the city's contract costs. There's a 41% difference between 725 and 1025 an hour. So we applied that rate to certain contracts that we have that we estimated how much of the contract is labor and tried to make a ballpark estimate of how that might affect the city's costs. We estimated it to be about $12 million per year. Certain contracts, we really just were not sure what their employees were being paid or what the breakdown between costs and supplies and materials was. So it was difficult to make that estimate. We also tried to assume, you know, which contracts had the employees at the lower end of the pay scale, because we know that not all of our contractors' employees are being paid less than $10.25 an hour. So our largest labor contracts are temporary labor for sanitation, and I do want to point out I have a little bit of a misstatement here. It's $2.5 million is the estimated contract cost increase, $4 million to bring the employees in house. So I will get that corrected on the PowerPoint for you. So, you know, we would have to look for ways to address and absorb the additional contract costs through other fee changes, other budget reductions to offset any cost increases to the city. We also would want to consider achieving the goal of increased salaries for Dallas citizens. If we don't know where the vendor's employees live, if they live outside of Dallas, that doesn't help Dallas's citizens. The city cannot use a residency require as the basis for paying a higher wage. We would also want to consider how vendors could accommodate this change if they are able to allocate employees' time to their various contracts. Just do not want to discourage people from bidding on our contracts. Also looking at, need to consider how we would enforce the ordinance, a proactive approach and audits, or more of a complaint-driven investigation of wage complaints. So there are just some other ideas that we need to take into consideration. So in conclusion, the 1025 wage floor on city's contracts would be likely to increase our costs, current estimate about $12 million a year. We don't have any idea right now of how that might affect our revenue contracts. And then again, no option to change requirements on construction contracts. So I'll conclude there.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold.
It's me. Thanks, Mr. Mayor.
I'm sorry.
If we increase a contractor's, a prospective contractor's labor cost by increasing the wage floor to a livable wage, they would be likely to invest more heavily in capital, no? I'm saying your estimate's pretty simple. I think that what we'll see if we move forward with requiring future contracts to pay their contractors their contract employees a living wage is that they will, that will not be a dollar for dollar increase in the contract bids. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, we really don't know at this time. So, you know, we would just have to, as each contract will rebid, manage any cost increases that are there, so.
And is the manager's office bringing forward any professional recommendation?
We are just providing this as an informational briefing at this time.
And so what is the plan for implementing any changes to the policy that this council chooses to make?
So we would, as we move forward with new contracts being bid, we would need to analyze the costs differential and work to manage that in the city's budget.
Okay. So assume with me for a moment that the council will decide that, at least with regard to city contractors, we want a living wage. I don't know if that's true, but I suspect it is. What would be your next step? Should the manager's office perceive that the will of the council is to move in that direction?
So I would look at the upcoming procurement, because not all of our contracts expire next year. So I would probably give you an overview of which contracts I expect to bring forward next year and how they might affect the budget.
And you could give us a schedule of that.
So. Absolutely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Might have been helpful to have that today. It seems like we're going to have to do this again. This is an issue that we've been talking about on this council for over a year, and every time we talk about it, we say we're going to have a discussion. So we're finally having the discussion today. And the reason that this is important to me is a couple of things. I have, in doing research regarding living wages, what I have come to believe is that the benefits that the community reaps from having people make a sufficient amount of money to handle their own expenses, including their health care, is offsets the cost of doing it in a number of ways. One thing we may want to do is interface with the county, because I believe our primary savings as a community will be in reduced deficits at Parkland. When people go for health care, they may be more able to pay for their own health care. And I think that's one way in which we will be able to reap some benefit. And I would have liked to have seen some of that in the briefing, really, about what are the... The briefing to me seems a little bit slanted against the idea of living wage. And it's probably not because of an intent to be against living wage, but really more just a failure to consider the benefits of it. I was having a discussion with Clay Jenkins about a year and a half ago on this issue, and he was talking about how he wants to do this at the county level also. And he told a story which I thought was really interesting. He has a law firm, and he hired a gentleman to do a bunch of different tasks for the law firm, runner, all kinds of office administrative activities. And when he was thinking about how he was going to compensate this man, he said, you know, if he comes to the office Christmas party and I know that I haven't paid him enough to take his kids to the doctor, I'm going to have an awfully hard time making small talk with him. And I thought that was I thought that was impactful. I think that that's a value that a lot of us can share. We need to be cognizant of the increased costs, but I think we don't need to be so fearful of them that we put people who work for the city of Dallas, essentially, our contractors essentially work for the city of Dallas, in situations where their lives are not sustainable. We're going to pay for that one way or another. And I'd prefer to pay it on the front end, encourage. It's not about rewarding people out of step with the actual value of the work that they provide. In conjunction with looking at these issues, what I would like to do is make sure that the job descriptions for which we hire are challenging, are worth the kind of money we want people to be able to make on an hourly basis in the city of Dallas. That's another, I think, potential benefit that we could reap from this is higher efficiency, essentially. I think that we're going to be able to offset the costs of, more than offset the costs of this with the social and operational benefits that I think we're going to reap from this. I've got one other issue that's not really substantive. I'm looking at the July 1st memo that I and four others sent to the mayor asking for this, July 8th, sorry, asking for this briefing. And the actual request was for a briefing of citywide living wage. Did somebody misread that?
I believe Mr. Ernst will respond to you on that.
The state legislature has preempted the city's ability to adjust the citywide minimum wage.
What is your basis for that statement, Mr. Ernst?
Labor code, state labor code section 62.0515. Except as otherwise provided by this section, the minimum wage provided by this chapter supersedes a wage established in an ordinance, order, or charter provision governing wages in private employment other than wages under a public contract. And then it has an exception which permits governmental entities like the city to enter into their own contracts with private entities establishing a different minimum wage.
And does supersede mean preempt?
That is our interpretation.
Is that also based on an AG's opinion from former AG Abbott?
There is an AG opinion addressing county treatment. That's one attorney's opinion, as I've said before. And that goes to county, which does not have home rule.
Give me an example of if this council were to pass an ordinance that you believe is in variance with that section of the labor code. Give me an example of what bad thing you think would happen.
I believe that we'd be subject to action both by the state and also by an employer who we would claim would be subject to our ordinance.
So an employer would be paying less than a living wage, and the city would say, here's an ordinance that requires you to pay a living wage, and that employer would say, pound sand or whatever, and then we would take some kind of enforcement action against that entity?
I can't predict exactly how the litigation would come down. I suspect that employees or associations supporting employees might seek to enforce our ordinance. Employers would seek to have the ordinance declared preempted by the state law, and it would proceed into court battle.
Okay.
So whether the city took the enforcement action or not, I believe I could see where associations supporting employees might well do so.
So your legal opinion that a citywide living wage ordinance is unenforceable led you and the manager to conclude that we would have no discussion of it today?
We're prepared to discuss it. We are discussing it.
I mean, we don't really have any sort of information on the economic effect of such an ordinance. I don't think we would have had much in the way of legal advice if it weren't for me raising the issue. The second part of the memo said that staff would bring in an outside expert to brief us on citywide living wage, and that didn't seem to occur. I'm sensing some hostility to this request, quite frankly. Did you read this memo, Mr. Gonzalez? It's two sentences.
Yes, I read it.
Well, how do we get two sentences and miss half of it?
I'm not sure which half you're talking about. If you're talking about the half with the having to do with the citywide application, the city attorney sent out a memo in that regard. And the other half, which I'm not sure that it was quite explicit, the other parts having to do with what the city could do within the organization is what you got a briefing on.
The charter of the city of Dallas is its foundational document. It says if five of us send a memo to the mayor that he's going to put the requested material on the agenda. That didn't happen today. The charter has been violated, and I do not intend to let violations of the city's charter go unnoticed. Don't let this happen again. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mayor. And just one commentary. Thank you for your legal opinion that that this is, it's not a case of being whether it's enforceable or not. It's a case of whether it's legal or not for us to mandate living wage across all businesses. But I do want to speak a little bit to wages and wage floors, both living wage and minimum wage. You know, in my education as an economist, it's quite frequently noted that wage floors create two problems. One is they're typically said that it's inflationary because you are pushing more money into the system, and then that causes prices to go up. You're also causing labor prices to go up. And the other is that argument is that it, in a simple supply and demand model, you're cutting off workers that are not qualified to work at a higher rate, and then you're actually cutting off part of the workforce. And for a long time, I've been a believer in that. But as this came to the city, I took it upon myself to try to do some research of current thinking, since my economics thinking was based on some thinking that was in the 80s, and I will acknowledge that the world has changed. And when you actually look at the current research and the current thinking, those two items have really been shown not to hold true. In the case of inflation, it has been shown that the number of people that benefit from an increase to a living wage as opposed to a minimum wage is small relative to the entire workforce, and it's not enough to really move the inflationary number, especially in a period which we are in right now of historically low inflation. Just won't move the needle on inflation by providing a living wage. The other thing is with regards to employment, you know, we are also in a period, especially in our region, of low unemployment. And again, there's a scarcity of employees, and providing a living wage to the employees that are currently working does not push them out of the workforce. And that's just what the more recent studies have been showing. So I've kind of reevaluated my position on it, and I'm, you know, supportive of the city requiring a living wage in the contracts that the city issues on its behalf. I do realize that is going to cost our citizens about $12 million in our budget. That's about a cent and a half of the tax rate, which we'll be having a conversation on that in another week or so. But it is, I do believe it's a good and worthy policy. I think it does attract, there is the question about does it help citizens of Dallas versus citizens of the suburbs. I think by its nature it does, and this is just my assumption, it does attract people to want to live in the city, you know, maybe lessen their commute by getting a better job in the city. I'm supportive of this initiative. The other thing I want to mention is in the model, I'm sorry, one more commentary on the minimum wage. If you look at like Pew Research, you can see that even the current minimum wage, which is $7.25, if you inflation adjust that wage, it is basically about $3.45 if you inflation adjust it back to the 40s when minimum wages were first contemplated. And minimum wage peaked out in about the mid-70s at about $8.50 or so an hour. So even the minimum wage has not kept up with inflation. With regards to the city and how we're going to compute the living wage, I noticed in the briefing that you referred to the mayor's poverty task force had picked this number of 1025. I'm not sure where that number came from, but I would encourage us not to use a specific number, but to use a reference point number, much like people do when we do CPI. A very good one is MIT has a MIT has a living wage calculator that calculates it based on a county-by-county basis, and it's actually showing that for a single adult, the living wage for Dallas County is $10.37 an hour. So I'm not sure where the 1025 number came from, but I would suggest that when we do city contracts, we do it based on a reference point, and that way, as living wage changes or living wage increases, we're not stuck. And you know how sometimes policies get stuck forever. We're not stuck 10 years down the road with, you know, a living wage requirement that could be lower than possibly a minimum wage requirement. So let's do it as a reference point. But I think you guys are going down the right path trying to figure this out. I do very much appreciate that we're figuring out what is going to be the fiscal cost to the city, because as many of you know, that's probably one of my highest concerns in all areas. But overall, I think it benefits the city more by at least the city contract providing a living wage than not. So, thank you.
Mr. Griggs.
Well, thank you, Mayor. Thank you for the briefing. I support going ahead and implementing a wage floor for all city contracts. So I would like staff to come back with a mechanism. One question will be, because I know we have so many contracts, how many contracts would this affect immediately with the impact on this next year's budget, and then moving forward with an implementation schedule. I also support the idea of picking a benchmark or a metric, as Councilmember Kleinman suggested, for a living wage. If that's 1037, what's being proposed by MIT with their living wage calculator for Dallas County, I think that's a good spot. I think the mayor's task force on poverty did a good job with 1025. So I would support moving forward with the 1037 for all city contracts. Dallas is just it's an expensive place to live. And certainly the growth in wages, particularly people who make a minimum wage, hasn't kept up with the rest of Dallas real estate. It hasn't kept up with the rest of Dallas, the returns made on investment. And so it's led to a situation where we particularly saw it in the Neighborhood Plus presentation at our housing committee, just the growth of poverty here in the city of Dallas, particularly in southern Dallas, is poverty is growing, and that's a trend we need to combat. And I do believe one way we can do it is by putting in a minimum wage floor for these city contracts. It's not going to help obviously everyone in the city, but our hands are tied by what the state law is. But this component certainly is in our control, and I believe we need to move that direction. And this is a good time to have the discussion with the budget going on now. So I certainly support implementing the 1037, tying into the living wage benchmark proposed by Mr. Kleinman, and staff coming back with a actual implementation plan, because we do want to understand what the impact is going to be on the budget, both near and 12 million. I understood this 12 million to be the 1025 once it was implemented and in effect for an entire year. So there's also a transition period, and also tying it to the 1037 will change the impact a little bit, both in the transition period where it's not in effect for an entire year because we've got some contracts that we can't change, and then going into how it will affect a full fiscal year. So I'd like to go ahead and make that a motion for staff to come back with that proposal.
Second. Where's our city attorney? Oh, there he is.
He's up there.
More?
He's
I really did list here.
This is not an action item today. It was not posted as action. Can we take action on this?
We can certainly have a motion to direct staff to move forward.
So we'll take an action item on that motion?
Yeah.
And so it wouldn't put it into effect. This is just to come back with an implementation schedule. And then that obviously could lead to an action item.
Okay.
With that, I'm, of course.
The motion in
yes.
Second now.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. Clayton.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Can we go back to slide four, please? You had mentioned that the cost, you know, referencing sanitation, that'd be $4 million annually, and that'd be applied, you know, to the sanitation fee. Do we have to do that?
So just to clarify, the $4 million is to hire the laborers as city employees. We currently have a temporary labor contract. If we were to rebid that contract with a higher wage floor in it, we estimate the impact is $2.5 million. We had talked back in June when we did the budget about creating a sanitation enterprise fund. So I would say that yes, that would need to go in the fee because enterprise funds recover their costs through their fees.
Educate me for a second, but doing it through an enterprise fund, it makes a profit, right? It's not a zero sum where at the end of the year it's exactly zero, right?
It generally about breaks even for the proposed enterprise fund for next year. I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this.
Well, the way it's we have set up sanitation, whether or not it's it was in a general fund, but we operated much like an enterprise activity in the sense that we would set the rate to recover the cost for that residential pickup. So in the rate was there to basically completely pay off those amounts needed for the operation. Now there's a landfill also associated with that operation in which there was, if you will, some profit, but there's other aspects of that operation that were taken care of by the general fund, and so those profits were used in the general fund. Because of Gatsby rules, we should be moving and should have been moving some time ago of segmenting that operation into its own fund, and which we're implementing this year. And in so doing, we'll have those costs segregated in a more clear way, but the general approach is going to be the same. We will look for a rate that will cover the cost of the operation.
Got it. When I originally, you know, saw the slide, maybe wrongly, I made an assumption that that's something that we need to pass on, you know, to the consumer. And, you know, when I look at the budget, you know, there's needs in the budget and there's wants in the budget. If we decide as a council that we need to raise this wage for whatever reasons we decide collectively, then I don't think the foregone conclusion is we need to put it on the back of the consumer. And so that's why I asked the question. Can you go to page six for a moment? So in doing our service contracts, if it's the will of the council to go this direction, which I think there's some movement for that, right now it's the wages that are paid to employees. So we don't know, if I understood you correctly, if they pay a minimum wage, what we define living wage, or somewhere in between, correct?
Right, we don't have that information.
Do we have a legal capacity, if we so choose, to use it as a factoring criteria? So right now we give special consideration to if you're a minority-owned business, if you're, you know, women-owned business. Can we give that as a criteria, 5%, 10%, based on the wages paid to employees? Because I would make an argument, and I will not do it near as articulately as Mr. Kleinman, though I did get an A in economics, by the way, so I can talk Keynesian economics with you. But I can certainly make an argument that in dealing with the city, as you're going to apply, that as somebody who wants to have market rules, that you can make a choice of I know that if I pay my wages here, I can do a break even on that, and I'll either choose to do business with the city or I won't. I will choose to accept a smidge less of profit in exchange for the stability of the contract, in exchange for the stability and the happiness of my workforce, because the reality, as a small business owner, I can tell you, if you pay your people little, you get little in return. If you pay them fair, you get fair in return. So do we have the capacity to do that?
I'd like to discuss that in an executive session.
Well, I'd love to discuss that in closed session.
Do you want that question answered?
Yes, please.
Okay, then we will do that. Let's figure out, when we go into executive session, we got a couple other items that are quick. I'd probably kill two birds with one stone. Do you want to talk about some other things first and then?
Let me just finish my point.
Please. Okay. We will go into executive session for that if you wanted to.
Thank you, and I appreciate your consideration. Can you go to page 13, please? Ms. Chipperfield, you had said, if I understood you correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we don't know what the wages are that these companies are paying, correct?
Right.
But you made an assumption in there.
Right.
How can we make that assumption?
We looked at the types of contracts that we have, and we looked at the type of work that's being done, and just based on the city's pay scale, looking at what types of positions are at the lower end of the pay scale. So we made an assumption that certain types of contracts, grounds maintenance, janitorial, that those are lower paid workers, and if they were, and we also made an assumption of how much of the contract cost was likely to be allocated towards staffing costs. And so it's an educated estimate or an educated guess for us to make the $12 million projection. Like I said, we don't know how much of their costs go towards salaries. We don't know how much their employees are being paid. So it's an estimate. We won't know until we actually go out and rebid our contracts if the council adopts a policy. Right. So it could be less.
Thank you. Just echoing kind of what I said a moment ago, I think one of the things that if we're going to start instituting best practices, which I believe we should, and I think we do to a degree, I think looking at P&Ls would be a good way of doing that, especially if the will of the council is to start incentivizing businesses that pay a wage that's more conducive to 2015 than 1978. I think that would be a good idea. Lastly, on page 14, you had mentioned, if I understood you correctly, about the vendor's ability and desires to do business with the city. I don't think that's a consideration that we should have, frankly. As a business owner, you choose to get into, for lack of a better way of saying it, you choose to get into bed with somebody or not. And they need to make that choice. And when we go into closed session, I know we can address it, but I think we maybe sometimes overinflate how we want the desires of the business community, and we underinflate the moral, structural, ethical dilemmas that we face as a city trying to take care of our own. Mm-hmm. And I would just caution you that we take that into account as we go. And thank you for allowing us to go in closed session, and I appreciate all the time.
Yeah. In fact, if there are any other comments, we can take those now, and then we can, and then we can kind of wrap it up with that. Ms. Grayson.
Thank you, Mayor. I wanted to ask the city manager, the budget recommendations coming out the end of this week, is there going to be a proposed fee increase as part of that budget recommendation for sanitation, proposed fee increase?
Yes.
So whatever that is, and I don't know if you want to tell us now or have us wait and see it on Friday, but we would be talking about adding $1.60 to that already fee increase proposal.
That's correct.
I guess I'd like to say, I'm not sure I don't agree with Mr. Clayton that maybe we don't necessarily put that on the backs of the sanitation consumers paying that fee, that maybe we look somewhere else for that?
That revenue that would be needed would have to be coming from somewhere. And that,
you're talking about for this living wage or this?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
And targeting it for those customers is done as much as anything else to tie the cost of that delivery of that service to what it costs. And I think, in deference, if we start getting away from that, then we get away from the notion of that, what does it really cost us to provide a particular service? And when we use that cost or the rate that we have to compare against other jurisdictions, or when we're looking at trade-offs with regards to how we might want to deliver that service differently, you know, limit the amount of brush as an example to pick up, or pick up those bins in different places, et cetera, to become more efficient, we lose sight of what that really does for us when we start, if you will, subsidizing from other locations.
Fair enough. And you mentioned something that was going to be part of my next comment, which is bulky trash. Before I ask my folks to support big fee increases for sanitation, I'd like to see my problem solved about the poor bulky trash pickup in my district and the fact that we have to wait 10 days in parts of the district for that. And I know that staff was working on that. I'd like to know that there's going to be a quick implementation of the changes before I ask my folks to support a large fee increase for sanitation.
Yes, ma'am. We are working to get those particular situations taken care of through adjustments in some of the routes, et cetera.
Do we have a target implementation date for that?
I don't have that right now, but I can get that to you.
I'd like to hear that, please.
Yes, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I know there was some discussion of changing the boundaries of the districts to kind of more fairly allocate the number of households, and so I'd like to know when that's going to be implemented. I had thought we were looking at a target date of sometime toward the end of this year.
Correct.
So I'd like that information.
Yes, ma'am, we'll get it. The more global aspect of brush, however, if I might just use the opportunity since you're bringing it up, is that when we look at other systems that we compare ourselves to, the amount of brush that we allow, the amount of items that we allow to have been put in front of our homes is nothing short of just extraordinary. And I mean that in a very specific way. It's extraordinary. Virtually nobody does that kind of service. And in one pickup for one residence in another city to get that hauled away would virtually cost you the whole of the year for the cost of this service. So we're doing an excellent job, but we can be even more excellent about it, and we'll try to.
Well, I really thought that Mr. McDaniel did a great briefing for us months ago on potential changes to bulky trash, and they were major policy considerations that the council would have to make a decision on. But I don't want to see us slow that down. I want to see us continue to move forward towards some decisions related to bulky trash pickup.
Yes, ma'am.
And I particularly want to see us pick it up quicker in District 12. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just kind of a point of clarification. It sounds like if we have this momentum, which I think we all want to improve the quality of life of our residents here in Dallas, and it's a noble goal to be able to increase the wages. Mr. Riggs has asked that you would come up with the proposal that we could look at contracts, and I think that's in our authority, and I think we should look at that. You know, Dallas is a city in the great state of Texas, and I respect the Texas laws, and I don't really want to spend time on trying to figure out things that we don't have the authority to do. So thank you for keeping the attention on these contracts. I don't have any intention to try to look at raising wages in the city because I don't have the authority to do that, and I don't want to spend any time talking about it personally. and because there's a lot of things we can do, and there's a lot of things we need to do, and we need to get going and get those things done. So if you're going to bring that back to us, and I think there's, you know, it sounds like we have some great support for it, and then you're going to look at how that would impact this coming, look at the contracts, because we're not looking about altering contracts that are in that are in place.
Right, we would wait until
you would
they
just
expire.
You're going to present as part of the budget then all the contracts in the next fiscal year that would be renewing and what you kind of gauge for the fiscal impact of that. So we can make that understanding with that knowledge. Is
right.
that correct? Okay.
Yeah, we'll do that for you.
All right. And I think looking at the ideas that both Mr. Griggs and Mr. Kleinman about having that, I mean, I think obviously the Poverty Task Force did a pretty good job if they get pretty close to that number of 1025, but having that, maybe do a little more research on exactly what that number should be that we look at. And there might be other numbers out there, just not MIT or other indexes, and that would be helpful when we're given that choice. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Just a couple of comments myself. First of all, I believe the minimum wage paid in the United States is an embarrassment to workers, and it's something that I have a lot of passion about. Therefore, this is of great interest to me. I say that, and then I want to just say a couple of things. First of all, I think it's insulting to call this a living wage. That's a political term, and it does not, no one can live on 1037 or 10, whatever we're talking about. And I like to be as honest and transparent as possible to people. I do believe the term of, you know, that kind of wage floor for contracts is what we're discussing. And I would prefer us using that term as we kind of move forward. The second thing, from historical perspective and for new council members, we've had this discussion twice before in the budget for last year and in our strategy planning session this January. And I'm pleased to see the appetite has picked up, because I asked if there was anybody that wanted to move this ahead in strategic in fashion at the strategic time to talk about it, and it wasn't. So I'm pleased that we're doing the hard work. What we want to accomplish and how we want to accomplish it, to me, are a little bit disconnected. I think what we want to do is raise the income of workers and citizens of Dallas in a way, and we're going to kind of lead by example. And the question is, should we take $12 million out of our budget for streets, for public safety, for these other things, and put it for that? We'll have discussion and debate on that. But I think it's a good enough idea. We need to tee up and have that discussion. I think it's a healthy thing to do. Besides the legal issues that we'll talk about here in executive session, I am concerned that some of those money that would be used for bulky trash or whatever it might be going to citizens of Garland and Mesquite and Duncanville and DeSoto. And we don't even know what percentage of employees kind of are temporary and kind of move on. And so I, as a fiscal, fiscally minded person, I want us to be very thoughtful about how we spend this $12 million if we're going to spend it. And we put the belts and suspenders on to know that it's as focused as best as possible. I think many of us around this room would love our police to be living in the city of Dallas, and would love our fire to be living in the city of Dallas, would love every worker that we take money to and put out there to be living in the city of Dallas, that's problematic at times. And I think that's a consideration that I just wanted to tee up for everybody. That's it's something that's in my heart. I mean, you know, there's another way to approach this and say, how do we take $12 million out of this budget and get it to poor people in the city of Dallas? That's a whole nother proposition. I mean, because there's ways to do it in a very crisp and clean way. This is one way, okay? Poor people at work, if you will. But there's probably two or three other ideas that are up there. So I'm a real proponent of discussing this, but I think assuming the how on this, we've got to be very thoughtful about how we proceed. And in closing, I just realized we don't need to take a vote. I can ask the city manager to do what Mr. Griggs suggested, and so we're going to go ahead and do that and bring this process forward and say, if we did it this way, what are the if, ands, and buts about that? But I do want to answer Mr. Clayton's legal question. So what we're going to do now is go into executive session. We'll take up a couple other items. How long is our patio discussion, Mr. Gonzalez? The sidewalk cafes and streetscapes.
Extremely short. It's just simply a recommendation for the investment associated with sidewalk cafes and street amenities.
I think that we're going to go ahead and put that off till 1, okay? Because I think these conversations will go for probably 30, 45 minutes, okay? And then we'll pick that up at 1 o'clock. And we'll do it. Excuse me. I'm sorry, Mr. Callahan.
Yes, sorry, Mayor. I had to leave the room for a moment, so I did not get to weigh in on the
report. Oh, please.
It's a very
please have at it.
Very important issue there. And I, too, also support this concept of living wage, even though I know that in reality is not going to make it really a huge increase in wages, but I do think there should be a substantial floor. It is about fairness, and I think we have a moral issue to the workers and the citizens of Dallas to do everything in our power to increase wages. You know, since the Great Recession 8 years ago, we really haven't had any substantial increase there yet. Prices and cost of living has gone up. Relative inflation has not gone anywhere. As Mr. Klein was talking about, the needle hasn't moved that greatly. But if you look in terms of food prices, you look in terms of cost of insurance, vehicle prices, a lot of things have gone up. The only good news right now is gasoline prices are a little bit less. But when you factor that all in, and even if you do increase this to $10.37 an hour, you got a lot of people, you know, living in apartments together, multiple families living in houses together just to make ends meet, you know, and so there's a lot of potential that I think that we could really turn loose in this economy, that those monies are going to be quickly reinvested. With that disposable income, I think there's going to be an economic spillover. I think that would be very important. But I think it's our responsibility to use really every tool and every leverage possible to close the disparity between the wages and the cost of living, and that's what I'll be working for within the purview of the law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Callahan. Ms. Young.
Just a brief comment that I do support raising the wages, but I would just like to request that we have a more balanced presentation the next time. I saw nothing but a bunch of cons this time, so I would just like to request a more balanced presentation. Thank you.
Ms. Grayson.
Mayor, I was wondering if you could give us examples of those two or three other ways that you were talking about that we might be able to help poor people.
Well, I think I would be ideating on the spot. But imagine if we would set up an agency where someone brought in, that they were a citizen of Dallas and that they worked and we paid them a bonus. Okay, I mean, I just, you know, who knows?
Okay, I thought maybe you had like two or three really specific ideas that you might want to discuss with us is versus a wage floor.
Yeah, no, I was saying I haven't even approached the thing. Imagine if we all had $12 million and we were trying to get it to those people. I bet this group would come up with a lot of ideas.
Besides a wage floor, to spend $12 million.
The issue with this is that you really are cascading money through a circuitous route to get it to those folks, okay? You know, you're giving it to a provider that has probably hires a temporary service that hires people that may or may not be here.
I see.
And then we have to double check all that to make sure that happens. That's all. And, you know, it may be the best way, but.
Okay, thank you. I just was wondering, I thought maybe you had some really kind of two or three thoughts out there that
No.
Okay, thank you.
No. I know it's not Mr. Arnold, it's Mr. Kingston.
Just real brief, I just want to echo Ms. Young's comments. I know I said it before, but that $12 million estimate, I don't know what the total cost of this is going to be, but I now know for a fact it won't be $12 million because that method of estimation artificially inflates the impact of this potential policy change. And I think that's an example of that. I also was struck by Mr. Callahan's comments about the potential economic impact of higher wages in the city of Dallas. And I was thinking if we were to calculate that economic impact in the same way that we, for instance, calculate the economic impact of our spending on the convention center, then we could pay for this with the money we save.
Thank you. Okay. So folks that are here, we'll come back at 1 o'clock. It is now, we're going to stay here, City Council, we'll stay here. It is now 10:54 a.m., August 5th, 2015. The City Council will now go into closed session under Section 551071 of the Texas Open Meetings Act, receive advice and consult with the City Attorney on legal issues relating to employment and contract law raised by the living wage discussion. Allegrio de Leon v. City of Dallas, and Manuel Enriquez v. City of Dallas. Thank you.
A permit process whereby the entire city is licensed, and then in order to exercise sidewalk cafes, you need to come and get an administrative permit to do that. With that, the folks here at the table with me are Art Hudman, the city attorney over real estate. I've got David Cossum, the director of sustainable development. And I've also got Ashley Eubanks, who is our manager of our real estate division here with Dallas. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to David.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Nothing like after lunch to talk about cafes. But as Ryan mentioned, this was an issue that's come up and has a great deal to do with our utilization, our complete streets program, activating the streets, and really working on enhancing the quality of life of the pedestrian experience within the city. This has been a discussion that's been going on for probably the past 10 years in terms of altering our fee structure somewhat and making some other changes to the process. Back in 2004, council did approve a five-year pilot which made a one-time fee for certain things, for landscaping, awnings, and such things as subdivision signs. And we adjusted the fees for sidewalk cafes at that time as well to lower that amount. Then back in 2009, we extended that program indefinitely, and that's where we are today. We did first reopen this discussion back in June of 2013 with the Quality of Life Committee. We talked more about the current license fees, how some restaurants felt like it was an impediment to being able to implement a sidewalk cafe, and basically negating any benefit of enhancing some of the neighborhood life by not having a more ability to open these sidewalk cafes. So in November 2013, Quality of Life did instruct staff to move forward with a reduced fee proposal. That was eventually forwarded to City Council. At that time, however, Council instructed staff to go back to the Economic Development Committee for some additional discussion. That happened in April of 2014, and the committee requested that we look at reducing fees even further and try to come up with other ways that would be more efficient for use of public right-of-way and sidewalk cafes and other streetscape elements. Since that time, we have done additional research on best practices, what other cities are doing, fees that other cities are charging, limitations within both our charter, our code, and state law, and how we might come up with some different ideas, which we will present to you now on basically improving that process. So a little background, really, just to go over those that aren't familiar with the state requirements and our code requirements dealing with right-of-way and why it's a good idea to accommodate the use of right-of-way. Again, we've talked a lot about complete streets. We were implementing complete street programs among many of our thoroughfares within the city. Basically, this street character does help define a neighborhood, define a place, if you will, within the city. It activates the streets. It adds to the urban experience. It creates pedestrian-friendly environments, basically encourages additional street amenities, and spurs economic development. When we see this revitalization along our streets, it does have a positive impact on the economic activity in the area. And in addition, it just encourages more interaction between citizens, between pedestrians. It provides an opportunity to enhance, I think, the quality of life, really. The next slide's got, on page 9, has got some examples, just some pictures of some different street cafes within the city, street settings, just to give you an idea. Most of us have seen these in our travels, but just as examples. Sidewalk cafes currently are generally located in Bishop Arts, Deep Ellum, downtown, along Greenville, uptown, and in the West End. There are currently, though, only 42 sidewalk cafes that are licensed within the public right-of-way. We might note that there is a whole lot of outside seating within the city. A lot of that is actually on private property that does not require any type of license or extra permission from the city. It may spur additional reviews, but there's no additional approval required for a restaurant to provide outside seating on private property. So just a little background on why licenses are required. The transportation code basically gives the city authority to permit uses of the right-of-way and it outlines for specific reasons, landscaping, sidewalk cafes, ornamental features, street amenities, benches, water fountains, bus shelters, planters. But it has to be granted to the abutting property owner, or so they've got to have the underlying fee title or a tenant that has the right to use that premise. The Dallas City Charter in Chapter 43 of the code require licenses for private use of the right-of-way. Currently, that is something that's required to be granted by City Council by ordinance. Can only be granted to abutting property owners. Can't be inconsistent with or unreasonably impair the primary use of that area for pedestrian traffic. And then the city always retains the right to terminate as necessary. It also affords us the opportunity to perform due diligence to address any public safety concerns. It allows us to confirm that we're granting it to the adjacent property owner or their tenant. Location and coordination with other uses in the right-of-way, potential future expansion of streets related to streets or public works, as well as coordinating with our own utilities, DWU, and others such as Encore or Lone Star. Also enables us to make sure we've got the adequate insurance protection for the city and the indemnification of the city, and confirm that there's no hazards or other obstructions and we maintain adequate sidewalk clearance, and also can require restoration of the right-of-way. Current process is that there's a initial application fee, which is $750. This fee is credited currently to the first year's fee, if you will, or license fee. So right now, today, if it's a smaller cafe, that would be $1,000. They pay $750. That would be credited. They owe $250 for the first year's license. Then they'd be billed annually at $1,000. In addition, we need field notes that describe the licensed area and drawings showing their proposal, deeds confirming ownership and the tenant's lease that they have the right to use that, and then the written concurrence of the abutting property owner. Our current process is that we do route that, as I previously stated, to other departments within the city and outside utilities and outside entities. That would include DART in many instances. Any concerns raised by our responses to that routing must be addressed by the applicant. If concerns cannot be resolved, then the license never progresses beyond that point. It never makes it to council at that point. It's just denied at the staff level. License fee currently is determined through a formula based on assessed value or the one-time fee, whichever is less in this instance, or minimum of $1,000, excuse me. Commercial general liability insurance is required, and then the request is ultimately submitted to City Council for authorization by ordinance in accordance with our codes. The Texas Constitution does prohibit gifts of public funds, so this is consistent with that we have to have some types of fee established, but we also can show that there's a clear benefit that we articulate for granting a reduced fee, and that can be done. It's intended to recover costs associated with processing and reviewing the licensing requests. So to date, we've really kind of looked at three models, if you will. Historically, it's been a market-based model prior to 2004, where there's a formula within the code for most licenses that's based on the tax assessed value on the adjacent property, and that would establish the fee. In 2009, when we reduced our fees, it was pretty much an attempt to at least assure that we had cost recovery of the application process and the routing. Then what we're considering today really is a subsidy type model where we feel like the benefits of the amenity will outweigh any cost to the cities, in fact generate additional revenue through the cities. So where we are today now is back to you with a proposal, and we've got two options to consider. One is primarily focused on reducing the fees. We would set a one-time application fee of $100, which would not be credited to the first year license fee, but the sidewalk cafe fee would be $200 versus the formula that we currently use. So then on the streetscape, other licenses, amenities such as awnings, canopies, et cetera, it would be $100 one-time fee. We would not require a meets and bounds description, which basically you have to have almost a surveyor draw up, and then we would verify, which adds time to the process. We would allow just a measured drawing to grant the license. There's still going to be a requirement for the insurance, and then it would still proceed through our current process of going to council for authorization by ordinance. Would allow, again, maintain that council discretion on a case-by-case basis. The second option would basically be to grant a license through our Chapter 42 to anybody within the city to give them the right to come in and ask for this license. It would already exist, then it would just be a permitting process. We'd implement the permit process with reduced fees. We'd review it in a very similar manner. It would be issued subject to all ordinance rules and regulations of the city. Again, the downside here is we've removed council discretion on making a determination whether to grant or deny that specific license. There's already a license in place, then it's a ministerial process of reviewing it by permit. In addition, state law dictates that if we do a permit process, then there's a cash or surety bond requirement that would be sufficient to remove improvements and restore the sidewalk. The fees we're talking about, you know, pretty minimal in terms of the cost of bonds that would be proposed, and different ways to calculate based on whether the improvements are secured or not. Then again, we'd stick with the measured drawings versus the meets and bounds description, but you'd still need to provide your liability insurance. The permit fees would be the same as in Proposal 1, but the permit is issued administratively. Again, that eliminates any council discretion on issuing that particular license to a particular business. Just wanted to cover real quickly the budget implications. We've looked at this. We have come up with a very conservative estimate, so we're not really talking about an impact on our proposed budget this year. The revenue reduction Currently, we're looking at revenue of about $315,000. The reduced fees we're estimating with a 25% increase in applications, that would come out to about $175,000. So that would be a reduction in annual revenue based on our estimate of about $140,000. In addition, if there's any increased workload, that could be another cost consideration. So depending on which option we pursue, the next steps would be to bring forward to council the Chapter 43 amendment to either reduce the fee ordinance and leave it at that, keep the license provisions, or option two would be to reduce the fee ordinance, provide a permit process, and do away with the, well, we're granting the ordinance, adding that to Chapter 42, but make all the individual licenses, they wouldn't be individual licenses, and they'd now be granted by permit. And again, we could either leave fees as is or make the proposed amendments to those fees. Part of this will be to develop sidewalk design standards where we're ensuring adequate clearance within the sidewalk. You know, historically, other potential issues would deal with parking and noise. That's really a broad issue that captures not only things in the right-of-way but on private property and the way that's administered. But we certainly want to ensure design of the streetscape enhancements aren't a detriment to the neighborhood, that they do have the positive benefits. So we're recommending adoption of those design standards. Examples of those are on page 26 and 27. If you've got any questions at this time, we'll be happy to respond.
Thank you. Mr. Griggs.
Well, thank you, Mayor. Thank you, staff, for that presentation. I just showed an article to Lee Kleinman that I wrote on April 5th, 2010, before I was even on council, that the city should change this. So it only takes about a year and three election cycles to get through, and then for all the new people, if you. So things move fast here.
Don't give up.
Don't give up. So really, looking at just the. Because I certainly want to move forward with this, but looking at the inconvenience factor between the two, on one side, things have to go to council. So does that mean also CPC or just straight to council?
Straight to council.
Good. And then with option two, they would have to get the surety bond.
Correct.
So it's, for me, it's measuring the hassle, if you will, between those two. So do you have any opinion on which one would be more hassle, how difficult it is to get a bond? Most businesses already have insurance, so I know that requirement's easy, but how difficult is it to get a surety bond?
Well, I would point out that it's cash or surety bond or a letter of credit. There's other mechanisms. Surety bond and letters of credit, you know, I defer to people in the insurance and banking industry, but they are available. It's a 10% fee, so if your bond amount is, well, 10%, it runs 5 to 15%, but let's, for ease of calculation, 10%. If you're requiring a $5,000 bond amount, $500 cost to get that, they're available, particularly for creditworthy applicants. People who are less creditworthy are obviously going to have a harder time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the typical cost, so it's pretty easy to get, just the cost is going to be around $500 extra.
For purposes of kind of getting our head around it, pick the number 10%. It's about a 10% fee of the bond amount. It's not impossible. Like I said, it depends on how creditworthy the applicant is, their banking relationship, or their relationship with a surety bond provider. But if they can't get that, they can always put up a cash bond, which would be more expensive.
Yes, the cash bond would be
right.
Much more expensive. Okay, so, and then the other option would be, it just comes right to, they have to hassle by getting on an agenda and come to council.
The main difference, in my view, Councilman, the main difference is the agenda time getting before council. Due diligence still needs to be done in both circumstances. We got to make sure that it's not out in the street or blocking somebody else's entryway or windows, that people in wheelchairs can still get by on the sidewalk. All of those sort of things need to be done under either approach. It's just the agenda process of getting it on before the council. I think, frankly, one of the biggest things, one of the biggest time savings in this that we can do right now, either way is to go from the meets and bounds requirement to a measured drawing requirement. For licenses, you don't need a formal legal description of the area covered. You just need to be able to identify it and provide enough information to the staff that's reviewing it to make sure that there is sidewalk clearance and places aren't being blocked. So by lessening that and going with a measured drawing approach, I think that's going to save a huge amount of time, because we hear a lot of complaints about, well, we prepare the meets and bounds, they go for review, we've got something slightly wrong, it comes back, and that goes through a couple of cycles. Getting rid of that, I think, is be one of the biggest time savers.
Great. I think we need to move forward with this, with our growing urban core and our effort to create life between buildings, and with all the restaurant, cafe seating that this can create. So I'd be open to moving forward with option number one, which will require them to go to council. So I know there'll be more discussion, so I'll make a motion for that. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The proposed changes seem to contemplate permanent improvements being allowed in right-of-way. Am I reading that right?
No, sir. By permanent improvements, if you're talking about an irrigation system for landscaping, trees and other landscaping type things, yeah, it allows that. The very definition in the transportation code of a street cafe talks about removable tables, chairs, and other appurtenances. Now, we have applied that concept to cover things that are just bolted down, you know, so they don't walk off, and the wrought iron fences around it. But specifically excluded would be big brick walls and things of that nature.
Even when there's sufficient space to completely accommodate pedestrian traffic with the proposed permanent improvement?
Yes, sir. The transportation code, it was kind of surprising. The transportation code specifically identifies walls as being prohibited. So that sort of structure, it's not allowed. Now, I mean, frankly, you know, we've done some things subsurface, like the old downtown ice vaults that are under. But as far as major structures, we try to avoid that. Have there been some? I'm sure. But it's clearly that sort of permanent obstruction of the right-of-way, even if there's reasonable accommodation elsewhere, is contrary to both the statute and common law.
So the question is, who cares?
Well, first of all, ADA advocates who are patrolling our cities looking for tight corners and tight spaces that wheelchair people blind.
Stick to the hypothetical, please.
Well, who cares? They would be advocating that
of the hypothetical was adequate pedestrian access.
Well, one man's adequate pedestrian access is another man's obstruction, Councilman.
No, that's fundamentally false. Right. The ADA has pretty clear rules. So here's the issue. My neighbors, my businesses have been forced to jackhammer out improvements that they made that aren't hurting anybody. And, you know, I got this put onto the city's legislative package that the fine people who represent us in Austin didn't see fit to change that. But I just don't understand why we as the city of Dallas want to be the enforcement body for a rule that has no sponsor and has no one seeking to take advantage of it. The same state legislature that gave us that rule gave us a rule that said Encore can put its poles wherever it damn well pleases, ADA or no. If you try to walk from downtown to the Continental Bridge, our brand new lovely pedestrian bridge, it is an incredibly frustrating experience. We have many areas where the sidewalk has Encore poles right in the middle of it. And it's just, I just don't understand why the city of Dallas would basically hassle good businesses over putting in slightly more durable improvements in the right-of-way so long as they're not obstructing pedestrian access. And we could handle any amount, just as we are requiring them to be able to guarantee that they will pay to take them out, putting in bonds and seeking other forms of reimbursement for that stuff. I just don't understand why we couldn't just do the same thing. I would absolutely be in favor of simply exercising a little bit of prosecutorial discretion here. And if we see a plan like that, it's a massive who cares to me. I think I'm inclined to think that that bonding to keep the process administrative is more of a hassle than actually coming to council. The idea of agenda time being a limiting factor is a little hard to swallow when next week's agenda is 1,800 pages. I was unaware that there was an upper limit on the length of an agenda. And these don't really take up much space in the agenda. So if I understand your explanation that doing it administratively requires that bond, and that's, I get that. I've had many clients who had to bond for different reasons, for regulatory reasons, and it's a permanent headache, and requires them to undergo some administrative burden of managing their bonds and their bond relationships. So I think I'm leaning toward keeping it in council. Maybe I also like that discretion. I'm not sure. This is great. You guys are going to improve this city quite a bit. Whichever way the council decides to go on these options you've given us, I really appreciate the work on this. You did the right thing in terms of doing due diligence. I share Mr. Griggs' impatience for these changes. I have the patience of a hungry three-year-old, so I'm not sure how he held out this long. But thanks very much for the briefing. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Ms. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I think this is long overdue, and thank you, David and crew, for working on this. I think that was one of the first things I was involved in when I first come to the council, and I'm very like-minded with Scott and Philip on this particular subject matter. Users are, they're paying property taxes and CO fees and sales taxes and building permit fees and health permit fees. They're regulated to death. I want to keep the process very short, sweet, simple. It's evident the process is arduous because we only have 42 cafes. We're way behind the rest of America. I go to big cities pretty frequently, and cafes are everywhere. And I just can't help but think that if we simplify this process, that this will be an economic development boom, not only downtown, but in Bishop Arts and Deep Ellum and other Greenville Avenue areas. And I think there's a lot of opportunity citywide for this to become a better thing. So most of these businesses are maintaining these spaces anyway, weed eating, plants, mowing, picking up the trash. And because they're the adjacent property owner, I think they ought to inure the benefit of being there, in those spaces. So let's find the shortcut method. I also think that bonding method might be a little bit difficult. I mean, I think it obviously can be done. Mark said he would sell people bonds, if they want to buy them from him, but a little free commercial for him, a new council again. So, I think maybe going to the city, the fee approach. I appreciate the drawing. I think that'll help. I do have one question on that, though. Let's say if you're a brand new restaurant and you come forward, I would assume that you're going to have a site plan that's going to have to be obeying the meets and bounds idea right up front. I would think that would be the case.
Yeah, any development of private property is going to be associated with a survey and a meets and bounds description. Really what we found is that and once it moves to the right-of-way, as long as it's associated with that private property, that the just the drawing suffices. But you're correct that anything on the adjacent to it on the private property, we're likely to have a meets and bounds anyway.
So an existing restaurant that's already there, they'll be able to get by probably with a simpler drawing, but if you're brand yes, new, you're probably going to have to go the full meal deal.
Not if you're proposing something in the public right-of-way. It'll just be the drawing.
So you can do your site plan, setting just for your lease space, and then you'll be able to do the much simpler drawing for the extra space,
yes,
correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Lastly, as long as we're, enable the, obviously, people that are needs challenged to get by and it's not blocking, because, again, it is a public sidewalk, and I want to make sure that we do that. And I know a lot of these restaurants, no doubt, they're going to try to go out and create fences and screens and artificial trees and every kind of an encumbrance or impediment possible to try to use as much space as they can. That's going to require a little bit of regulation, but I do think this is going to really foster a lot of economic development that we need and want. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Callahan. Mr. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to second Mr. Griggs' motion so it didn't fail for lack of a second, so I don't think anybody shot about it. Okay. And then I did have a question, I guess, for Art or the group here. With regards to the bond, could we adequately fulfill the need there by just asking for a insurance rider that specifically indemnified the city of Dallas? And if so, could that make the process easier, and then we could just keep it an administrative process?
I didn't look at that specifically, council member. The statute calls very specifically for a bond. It talks about indemnification and insurance as additional optional requirements, but it didn't say in lieu of the bond. That might be something worth pursuing. Now, we currently require insurance and indemnification under our existing process. That might be a possibility. Being an attorney, I would like to follow the strict language of the statute.
Yeah, I mean, my main point is just
sure,
as simple as possible.
I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kleiman. Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. On page 23, when you talk about the cost, the revenue reduction, and you said that you potential revenue, you took into account you're going to have more of these. I mean, how do you figure out how many more you're going to have?
Again, it's an estimate. I think we just looked at simplifying the process would encourage more folks to apply, encourage folks that maybe never took the time to apply.
I mean, did you have that many calls and then they just, obviously Mr. Griggs identified that there's a lot of need for it, Mr. Kingston, which is great. I mean, but right. You threw out a number that you expected that. And so I just wondered.
It's really just a best guess estimate.
Okay. All right, thanks. And then just technically, I mean, I'll kind of defer to, I know this is really important to Mr. Griggs, on which way is going to be the easiest to simplify this process so we can encourage these cafes in Dallas. If it goes through the council, because we don't have a license, is that why you don't have to have the bond? I mean, because there's a general license for that overlays the city? I mean, it just seems weird that one requires a bond and one doesn't, and they're getting the same thing.
I wouldn't try to explain the rationale behind the legislation from coming from Austin. But what I have is, I do not, in the statute, I do not have a bonding requirement if you do an ordinance, but
okay,
it says if you want to avail yourself of this permitting process, one of the things you need to have is a bond.
Is a bond. And that's to remove it, like if they abandoned then and they had these.
Correct. It's a removal, restoration, and repair bond.
So, but we'd be granting them the same thing. We wouldn't have the means. We wouldn't have a bond the other way. Because it's a legislation. Okay. I just wondered why they're getting the same thing. Why one way is it required, one way it's not?
I'm not privy to the workings of the legislature.
Okay. All right. Well, I look forward to when this gets written up and. Well, Mr. Griggs, you can figure out which way is going to be easier since you get the most requests and let us know. So, and we'll support it.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold.
Just a quick question. Can you tell me, I don't remember which slide, but how many of these licenses have been issued in District 4 to these sidewalk cafes?
We'll have to get back.
on that. I don't have the broken out by district in front of me.
But just generally, are there many?
Not many, ma'am.
Okay, well then I think this sounds great, but I would love to have an opportunity to, from your office, tell me how we can grow those opportunities in District 4.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold, we'll provide that for all the council districts, but I will tell you one of the reasons why we're here is, if you look at 42 licenses into a city that's 383.5 square miles, that's one license for every 9 square miles in town. So not many. So that's the reason why we're here.
Just want to put a little plug in for District 4. We need that economic development. Thanks,
ma'am.
Thank you. That's it, Ms. Arnold?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
So much. Any other comments, questions? I'll work with the city manager's office, and we'll get this moving ahead and post it. Thank you, and we'll take Ms. Rios, your afternoon speakers.
We're going to begin with your afternoon speakers. They will be LaCoya London, Delveta Thompson, Dolores Phillips, Barbara Walker, Alendra Lyons, Cora Kennedy, and Isha K. Opal. I will first recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of the City Council. Any speaker making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks will be removed from the session of the meeting. Individuals are allowed 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice the timer on the television screen. When your time is up, please allow the next individual their turn. You should state your name and address for the record as well. If you have any handouts, please go ahead and hand them to to our officer, as it does affect your speaking time if you try to hand them out at the time your name is called. Again, your first speaker, LaCoya London. Not present. Delveta Thompson. Delveta, thank you, ma'am. Ms. Thompson will be followed by Dolores Phillips, Barbara Walker, Alendra Lyons, Kirk Kennedy, and Ejike Opa.
Ms. London showed up. Ms. Rios.
All right, ma'am. Ms. Okay. LaCoya London. All right, Ms. London. Ms. Thompson, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Okay. Hello, how y'all doing?
Good morning.
LaCoya London, 1411 North Cockrell Hill Road. Okay, I got a handout. Can I give you a handout? I just got one for you personally. Okay, I'm gonna give you a handout when I get through. I need you to see this handout. Okay, I have a handout that I'm gonna give you, and you're gonna need it because the Justice Department is coming down to go over my case, because I am Sandra Bland also. Kyla London is Sandra Bland. Okay, she was dragged down a DISD hallway in handcuffs a couple years ago. And the judge here threw it out on August the 9th. He threw it out on August the 9th. It stayed in court. And it went to court December the 9th, and it was thrown out August the 9th. We never entered the courtroom, never. So I don't know, it might be a political moment for some people, but I need to know how come we never entered the courtroom. The Justice Department want to know the same thing. Okay. Greg Abbott has a tape locked up, and it's showing her being dragged down that hallway of TJ Rusk Middle School. I came and told you about this. You was the mayor at the time. You're still the mayor. So I would like you to dig this tape up. Do whatever you can to get this tape, because the Justice Department would like to see it. Okay. 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 I too am Sandra Bland. Now I'm saying that DISD, bring it back. The city of Dallas and Dallas County, they all working together. So that's a problem. That's a big problem. Now I hope you new city council members truly are here for the citizens and not for the mayor. please don't be for the toll roads and all that, just that. Please be for the citizens, because they voted you in. Okay. I, too, am Sandra Bland. And one thing we do want to happen down there, we want the whole department to be closed down, because he killed her the first time he pulled that stun gun out and said, I will light you up. He killed her then, instantly. She was dead already. Okay. She made remarks about him being a something. I ain't going to say that on the air, but she made remarks about him, and it took his ego away. The same thing has happened to me here in Dallas with Officer Kine. You know, he told me to come out in 10 minutes in October, you know, after they already beat a lady down in L.A., they beat this homeless lady. So I got a problem with them thinking they can throw this case out. They came to my house a year and a half later to talk about the incident with him throwing her on the ground for littering. So I want something done, because we are Sandra Bland, too, and there's a lot of Sandra Blands and Trayvon Martins around America, and we need stuff fixed in the police departments. Thank you.
Thank you.
I got a copy for you, though.
Yeah,
can I give it to you?
Give it to her, right? She'll bring it over. Thank you.
This is the case that they throwed out.
Just hand it up.
I want you to.
Your next speaker, Delvita Thompson.
Ms. Thompson.
Good afternoon. I'm Delvita Thompson, 7904 Ivory Lane, Dallas, Texas, 75216, in the South Central Job Community. We do have the South Central Civic League Executive and Advisory Committee here present, if they could raise their hand. Back in the newspaper on February 27th, 06, one of the news articles saying, City has promises to keep in Joppa. The assistant city manager, Jill Jordan, who oversees the Trinity River project, describes the Joppa of tomorrow as a historic place and a fun place to live. Why the new interest in the community, residents say, has long been ignored. I can't do anything about the past, she says. I can only do something about the present and the future. Longtime residents of Joppa, a community of about 600 people, live in this community. We're here simply because we have been looked over with different bond packages, and things are continuing to go on with that. We voted on a bond package for our streets back in the 80s, 85, 86, and as of this year and next year, it would be 30 years, and still all of our streets have not been completely concrete, curbed, and sidewalked. In the same article, Dallas officials says Joppa of the historic treasure and have a pledge to lift its fortunes. Ms. Jordan described the dilemma as a crossroad because of different things that are going on in the community. The community is poised by major business development, she says. The question is, do the people of Joppa want to stay? If they want to stay, the city is committed to helping them do so. For better or worse, Joppa's immediate future is fused with the Trinity River Project. My grandmother was going to these Trinity River Project corridor meetings back in the 60s, and even though she passed in 97, I'm now taking up the fight with the community. One of the two roads into the Joppa floods during heavy rains, which is not true. This article did not get all the information, but it does force the emergency vehicles, the police department, the fire department, in coming across our railroad track, which is now by Union Pacific. City Council members Don Hill and Maxine Thornton Reese, who share representation of the community at that time, said that the city has invested $9.1 million into Joppa during the last decade. And we would like to see a breakdown of those things that have been done. We've seen some things, but we'd like a breakdown as well. Most of the money, more than $5 million, paid for the bridge over the railroad tracks, expected to open, which did, in April and May of 2006. We did sing We Come This Far by faith, because so many people had died in this neighborhood. So many parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts, and children died behind the railroad, blocking the way for the emergency vehicles. Mr. Hill and Ms. Reese both pledged $4 million for sidewalks, curbs, gutters, historic street lights, and for the construction of a gateway from Joppa into the Trinity River corridor. Now, we have our understanding that there's $1.9 million left behind with the councilpersons, former councilpersons, Mr. Hill and Ms. Reese, but...
Can you just wrap it up in the next 30 seconds here?
Yes, sir. But they're saying that they're wanting to use that now. The city is saying that they want to use it now for a bridge from our community over to the Texas Horse Park. We'd rather see our streets completed. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Young?
Yes, I just want to say thank you to the community of Joppa for coming down and being advocates for your community. I call that advocacy in action, and I would like to request that you would stick around until we adjourn. I'd like to meet with you. I live on the other side of the district in Pleasant Grove, and I, too, in my community, have the problem with Union Pacific blocking emergency vehicles, so I understand the frustration and the pain. And I did get the paperwork that was dropped off with me yesterday, so I'd like to meet with you all when we adjourn. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your next speaker, Dolores Phillips. I believe you received handouts from Ms. Phillips as well.
Hi, my name is Dolores Phillips. You do have handouts. The first one, the first two is going to be of 100-some pages that was filed on July 6th that was unfiled by Ms. Rios. I refiled them today. A total of 6 different documents. A slave master wrote in his own words once that a slave came to him and said, "Massa, why you treat me so bad?" With his hands flared out, gesturing to all the slaves, he said, "I couldn't do it by myself." What he was saying, in order for him to be the slave master, it had to be reinforced by slaves. So what I'm trying to humbly share with you is what Ms. London said, that for those new council members, please be for the people and not for the mayor. These handouts are a reminder of your corruption. And I'm going to be here every opportunity that I get to say that all lives matter, but Dallas is a reminder that black lives does not. I stand before you to say that I don't want to be treated any better than or any less than your white daughters, your white sons, your white citizens, and your white students. When I spoke of racism against United Parcel Service in 2007, I was blacklisted then. When I ran to college in 2008 trying to understand the Constitution as to why they thought that they could treat me less than, unlawfully, less than a white person, I was still blacklisted. From Mountain View to El Centro to UNT Dallas to UNT Denton, my education has been deliberately sabotaged internally. It's documented not by just what I allege, because the last thing they wanted me to do was to go to school. Mr. Rollins, when you instructed Corporal Cotner to take me to Green Oaks to intercept those court documents on October 25th, 2013, those documents were pertaining to United Parcel Service. When I alleged the FBI did not protect me as they would a white daughter, that is true, so I have become their target too, but I'm not afraid to live and I'm not afraid to transition. I need you to understand that if Dallas is a reflection of the nation, then America is doomed. I need you to know, Mayor Rollins, that I'm no better than or less than your wife. If you have a daughter, I'm no better than or less than your wife. I do not appreciate this harassment. And these people that works for the city of Dallas in Dallas County save you buku money, because your system of the oneness is really a tactic, very, very deceptively brilliant. Your psychological warfare of how you indirectly inflict fear on those minorities in women who come forward telling the truth of injustices, who have to be harassed by other minorities and women. And I need you to know, the only way your racism systematically survives is because of exploited minorities and women, who many know that they exploit and enslave other minorities and women. It's coming back in peace and truth. Everybody at the FBI ain't for Dallas corruption.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next speaker, Barbo Walker. Barbo Walker.
Thank you. You have a handout that I gave this morning. The title of the
handout. Mr. Walker, could you bring the mic down a little bit?
Oh, yes. Thank you.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you. The mayor and I, if the mayor and I look alike, we use the same barber. This presentation, this foolishness of political correctness, you have a handout on it. I'd like to go over this I'm privileged to be here this morning, Honorable Mayor and Council. Thank you for your time. 21 years ago, I was given the honor and privilege of sculpting Mayor Eric Johnson. The statue is in the lobby of this building. I did that, and what I'm here to talk about today is another sculpture, a sculpture in the Lee Park, one of the most famous equestrian sculptures in the country. It's of Robert E. Lee. When it was unveiled by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1936, he said, "I'm honoring a great American and Christian." Now, for foolishness, I believe foolishness of political correctness, there are people that want to remove that statue, and there is another group in this city that wants to destroy that statue. When is it going to stop? Is it going to stop when we tear down the Washington Monument, the monument to Thomas Jefferson? Both were slave owners. Or should we exhume all the men that fought for this country that are buried on Robert E. Lee's farm? That farm today is Arlington National Cemetery. I quoted a minute ago what the president said about Robert E. Lee. I would like to quote another president, President Barack Obama, who said just July the 1st of this year, "A nation and its people should not be penalized for the sins of the past." I would say a city as great as Dallas should not be penalized for the sins of perceived sins of the past. Don't tear down that statue. Don't change Lee Park. It's heritage. It's part of the history of this great, great city. And I thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for doing such a great job. I'm proud to be from Dallas. I have the opportunity to travel all over the world. This is a great city, and it's because of men and women like you. But political correctness has got to stop. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Your next speaker, Alendra Lyons.
Good afternoon. My name is Alendra Lyons, and I live at 4722 Collins, and I'm the president of the Mill City Association. And I am here to welcome you new council members and Mayor Rollins. Welcome back. I'm here on behalf of a situation that is going on in my neighborhood. On 4201 Metropolitan, there is a building that is there right across the street from the school that I've reported it in to code, but no action had been taken. I've been back for almost 4 years this September. I moved out of community. We've been in that area for 64 years, my family. And so that building is really, it's a hazard to the community. It's dilapidated. Someone purchased it in 2010. No work has been done on it. It really needs to be dealt with. That's my first situation. The second one is the railroad that follows the line Pacific Avenue to Baldwin. There is vegetation that's overgrown, and when I first started being the president of Mill City, I was able to get that taken care of, but now for the past 2 years, it hasn't been maintained properly, and I would like for that to be done, please. And my third issue is on 2nd Avenue in Metropolitan. There is a heavy situation with trash and drugs. There is a store owner, TMA, who really needs to work with the community, since he owns the property, to stop the people from loitering at his store so we can clean up that area, because that is the target area, the Mill City, that we would like to see come into a new development outside of what we're doing right at Elsie Faye Hagen's and Spring Avenue, where my children is located, ICDC. We want to do some things on Spring, but we also want to target the 2nd Avenue where it ends up at Fair Park. So those are my concerns today, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, and thank you for being president of the association. Ms. Young.
I just want to say thank you for coming. We had the opportunity for you to share these concerns with me last night,
yes,
and so
ma'am.
I went to work on them this morning, and my office will be in touch with you.
I need to say one thing. I thank the Dallas Police Department for working with us in Mill City, Chief Coleman, Sergeant Zimmerman, and Officer Rivera. Really appreciate them.
Thank you.
Your next speaker, Cora Kennedy.
Good afternoon, Mayor Rollins and panel.
I'm here on an issue, abuse of power, DPD. I would just like to ask you, Mayor, collectively, what are you doing about the abuse of power that have been in our cities? Let me say, my son was murdered in 2009. I do not know what happened to my son. 2120 is the property that you guys own, I believe, and there has been killings. There has been all sorts of things going on their property. And I do have a petition for their property to come down. The property is now being revamped. We've been in meetings. I believe I've spoken to your office, Mr. Thompson. I was supposed to meet with you, but I'm so busy. But the property is being revamped, and I'm being told by housing that there's asbestos there. We don't need that in our community. That building needs to come down. I'm being told that it needs to be conditioned before it comes down so fumes won't go everywhere. But we as a community of people need to work together, Mayor. I have seen you at town hall meetings, but you never spoke out about our issue with our babies being killed or anything like that. I would love for you to work with us closely on that. I think I've called your office, and I believe you work with Operation Blue Shield, if I'm wrong, correct me. We would love to work with you. We didn't get any justice. I work with moms all the time. Like I said, my foundation for my son is Mothers Against Corruption. We don't need corruption in our community. We don't need it anywhere in our city. I see you dancing with the kids on TV when, you know, every summer when they're getting their school supplies, and I see your smile, and I love what you do, and I love what all the panels here are going to do, but what we're not getting justice in this city of Dallas with our babies dying every day. Some things don't even hit the news. So if you could work with us and work with me, Mayor, I would love to work with you collectively on the abuse of power with DPD. We want to ride down the street and not be pulled over because we're in nice cars with our husbands, with whoever we're with. We want to ride down the street knowing that when we're pulled over, that it's justifiable. Not unjustifiable. That's what we want. And so thanks for listening at me. Mr. Thomas, I will call you, and God bless the panel.
Thank you.
Your next speaker is AGK Upa. Not present. That concludes your speakers, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Meeting's adjourned at 2:05 p.m. Thank you.
Hi, Ms. Lyons. Hi, I'm Chris Swecker. No, you spoke to somebody from my staff.